Topic number 3. When I recorded audio letter 57 last month, I mentioned that I had not yet received any reports or replies by Senator Proxmire to your letters. But since that time, many of you have let me know that he has answered you, and many of you have sent me copies of the letters that he sent you. My friends, in my 2 previous tapes, I cautioned you to beware of any attempts to just brush you off. If you have never written to anyone in Congress before, you may have felt that you got a very responsive reply from Senator Proxmire. If so, I suggest that you stop the tape at this point and restart it with your letter from Senator Proxmire in hand. Please follow along word for word. I'm about to read to you what you are likely to have received. If your letter differs from what I am about to read, by all means, please send me a copy. First, the date at the top is likely to be August 27, September 4, or September 9. Other dates are also possible, but large batches were sent out on those dates. Dear so-and-so, thanks so much for your recent letter concerning the allegations initiated by Dr. Peter Beter concerning massive gold thefts from the United States Treasury at Fort Knox, especially an unrecorded shipment which occurred in 1965. While this precious metal is no longer needed to back up our currency, I can certainly appreciate your concern in this issue. Similar concerns were expressed in 1974, at which time former Treasury Secretary Simon invited all members of Congress to participate in a personal inspection of the reserves held at Fort Knox. Several members joined in the tour at that time. In addition, at the request of the Congress, the General Accounting Office and the Treasury also completed an audit of the gold reserves. The General Accounting Office is an investigative arm of the Congress, as you may know, and participates in the yearly audits of the Treasury's gold reserves. As to the situation which took place in 1965 concerning the missing shipment of gold, I am asking the Treasury's Inspector General to give me a complete report. Once I have this information, I will be in a better position to determine whether any future action is warranted. I appreciate your interest in this important matter. Sincerely, William Proxmire, Chairman." Unquote. The signature, which looks for all the world like a personal signature, is Bill Proxmire, quote unquote. It looks pretty good, doesn't it? The tone is friendly, and it looks like a personal letter. And that is what you are supposed to believe it is. But of course, if your letter coincided with the one I just read, you know now that it was not a personal letter. It's just one of many identical letters churned out like popcorn by a computer-controlled typewriter. Even the signature, which looks so real, is made by a special signature duplicating machine. If you have a neighbor who also received a letter, put one on top of the other and hold them up to the light, and you will find that the computerized typing is identical, and you will also discover that the signatures are identical, unlike real signatures. They may be in slightly different positions on the two letters, but by moving them around, you will be able to make the two signatures coincide. My friends, the computerized letter is used by senators and congressmen today for several reasons. For one thing, of course, it saves work. For another, it makes constituents feel good, thinking they have received a personal reply. But most of all, it helps senators and congressmen avoid involving themselves in many issues. When you receive a personal letter from a busy senator or congressman, you may wonder, "Am I the only one who wrote about this?" Most people, if they think that, will just give up. And so the computerized letter is designed to encourage you to feel isolated. Notice that the letter I just read you from Senator Proxmire sounds as if he is answering you alone. He avoids mentioning that many others have written to him about the same thing. But you should know that in Congress, every letter is considered to represent at least 500 people. Now I invite you to look more closely at the actual content of Senator Proxmire's computerized letter to you. It's filled with red flags. First, in paragraph 1 is his statement that gold is no longer needed to back up the dollar. That is red flag number 1. It goes against common sense, history, and daily news about gold prices and the dollar. Senator Proxmire is parroting the old Rockefeller line, which was used years ago to calm us, to deceive us, while they phased gold out of Fort Knox and into their own pockets. The second paragraph is worded to convey the impression that all this has been looked into and found to be untrue. But read it carefully, my friends. You will discover more red flags. For example, he mentions the so-called tour of the Fort Knox Bullion Depository in 1974. But a tour is not an inventory, and not one of the visitors to Fort Knox in September 1974 was a specialist in gold. What is more, the visitors were not even told about, much less shown, the actual gold vault itself. This is a huge maximum security vault which occupies the central portion of the depository building and extends well below ground. Instead, the visitors were allowed to enter only one small jail cell-like compartment to look at some reddish-tinted alleged gold bars. In AUDIO LETTER 2 for July 1975, I gave details about all this. The Fort Knox tour of 1974 cited by Senator Proxmire was just a peep show amounting to a total fraud. Then he refers to the so-called audit of our gold reserves by the General Accounting Office and the Treasury. Another red flag, my friends, because an audit is not a physical inventory or count of the gold itself. An audit is only an examination of the books. And from the very beginning, my charge has been that those books are fraudulent and therefore useless. And to make matters worse, the audit committee consisted of 13 Treasury personnel, with only 2 GAO personnel tagging along to make it look good. I described that entire episode in detail in my audio book talking tape entitled The Fort Knox Gold Scandal and What It Means to You of March 1975. Paragraph 3 of the Proxmire computer letter is a tradition in Congress today. It's called Pass the Buck. But he does not even pass it to an objective agency. For example, he could have referred it to the General Accounting Office. At least the GAO is an arm of Congress itself, as Proxmire himself mentions. But no, you wrote to Proxmire about the Treasury's failure to account for a gold shipment worth over $1 billion today. And whom does he ask to look into it? Why, the Treasury itself. Actually, the only thing resembling concrete action mentioned in the letter is Proxmire's request for a report from the Treasury's Inspector General. So it seems appropriate to take a few minutes to tell you about Proxmire's previous experience with the Treasury Inspector General. The occasion was the scandal that erupted in December 1978 over missing gold at the New York Assay Office. As you may recall, there were news reports at the time that some 5,200 ounces of gold could not be accounted for. The story was brought to light only because of the determined efforts of a dedicated group of employees at the New York Assay Office. These employees, known as the whistleblowers, tried for years to seek redress for corrupt practices there among the top management. They contacted various officials within the Treasury, the Justice Department, Congress, including Senator Proxmire, and the press. For their efforts, some of them received severe retribution through their jobs, demotions, and so on. But against all odds, they succeeded in bringing to light the matter of the missing gold. Then, as now, Proxmire turned to the Treasury itself for a report on the possible misbehavior of a Treasury operation, the New York Assay Office. And on December 19, 1978, Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Robert Carswell wrote to Senator Proxmire and said, quote, "I must now inform you that there have been significant irregularities in accounting and management procedures in the New York Assay Office that appear to go back a number of years," unquote. Carswell added, quote, the full truth may never be known because of the inadequate records kept over the years." Unquote. In other words, my friends, the records at the New York Assay Office were unreliable, just like the records at Fort Knox. In his letter to Proxmire, Carswell also mentioned that the Treasury's new Inspector General had been assigned to the Assay Office case. The Office of Inspector General was a new office, created only 3 months earlier, and according to the Carswell letter to Proxmire, the first investigation handed to the Treasury Inspector General was that of the New York Assay Office. And so the Treasury's Inspector General began his career in that post with a case of missing gold. Now, according to his computer letter to you, Proxmire has asked him to look into another case of missing gold, the 1965 missing shipment from Fort Knox. The Treasury Inspector General took charge of a group of agents detailed from the Secret Service, which is another branch of the Treasury. Then he directed a so-called investigation of the missing gold at the New York Assay Office, which by his own words, quote, consisted of interviews, unquote, plus a review of security and procedures. No sworn testimony, just interviews. And oddly enough, no one confessed to any criminal activity or theft. So on May 11, 1979, the Treasury Inspector General closed the files on his investigation of the New York Assay Office. He wrote a memorandum that day to Deputy Treasury Secretary Carswell, summarizing the results of this great investigation. With one exception, a man who had already been sent to jail, he said, quote, "No evidence has been developed that any personnel were involved in the theft of gold and silver from the New York Assay Office." Unquote. That one exception is not discussed, but you might find it revealing. It was an employee who was caught trying to carry a bar of gold out the door inside a rolled-up newspaper. The reason he was caught, my friends, was that the gold bar slipped out of the newspaper and fell on the floor. The so-called investigation of the Treasury Inspector General also succeeded in deciding that less gold was missing than originally reported. What we heard in news reports was 5,200 ounces, but by the time the Treasury Inspector General got through, he had whittled that down to a mere 4,100 ounces. He also forwarded the sanitized Treasury report on itself to the Justice Department for their determination. Not surprisingly, the Justice Department wrote back that, quoting the Inspector General's memorandum again, "There is no evidence in the present record that any employee of the New York Assay Office personally benefited from the practices described in the report." Unquote. And the Justice Department is said to have declined prosecution due to, quote, "the absence of any motive of personal gain relating to the settlement procedures." Unquote. There was never another peep out of Senator William Proxmire about the strange goings-on at the New York Assay Office. Apparently, he was well satisfied by the self-serving Treasury investigation of itself, so much so that now he is passing the buck to exactly the same Office of the Treasury in the matter of the 1965 missing shipment of gold from Fort Knox. My friends, I never told you that what we are trying to do would be easy. I do believe that it can be done if we will stick with it, no matter what. But now you have a small taste of what we are up against. In the case of the missing gold at the New York Assay Office, Senator Proxmire acted as if he just did not want to know. So he relied on the Treasury to investigate itself through its Office of Inspector General. Now, in the case of the missing gold shipment from Fort Knox, his initial response, reflected in his computer letters to you, was the same. My friends, from what I've said so far, you may be thinking that I'm about to say, "Forget Senator Proxmire, we have to try something else." But that is not what I'm saying at all. There is more to the story, and a glimmer of hope that Senator Proxmire can be persuaded to take meaningful action. But I do believe that you must have a realistic understanding of the situation if we are to succeed. To that end, I think a few words are in order about Senator Proxmire's public background. E. William Proxmire got his start in politics long ago, after he married into the Rockefeller family. He ran as a Democrat for governor of Wisconsin in 1952, 54, and 56, and lost each time. But his big chance came in a special senatorial election on August 27, 1957. It was Proxmire, my friends, who filled the Senate vacancy of the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. Proxmire was re-elected in 1958 and has been in the Senate ever since. Throughout his Senate career, Proxmire has been deeply involved in the most powerful committees of Congress, dealing with banking, currency, housing, in other words, our economy. Whatever has happened during those years, Proxmire was there. In 1961, the so-called London Gold Pool Agreement was set up. It was an informal agreement that was never authorized by Congress. I repeat, never authorized by Congress. And under that agreement, our gold started flowing out of the United States in a hemorrhage that lasted nearly 7 years. One courageous congressman, Frank Shelf of Kentucky, spoke repeatedly on the floor of Congress about what was happening to our gold. In Audio Letter 2 for July 1975, I read to you his sworn statement about the secret shipments of gold out of Fort Knox during those years. But throughout the halls of Congress, the warning words of Congressman Frank Shelf were totally ignored. And Senator William Proxmire was among those who were there but paid no attention. And so we should not be surprised if we encounter resistance by Senator Proxmire to leading a public investigation of our gold reserves. Long ago, he became entangled with the special interests of the Rockefeller Group, who in turn spirited away our gold. And Proxmire was there in Congress when our gold was taken. So he could be accused of malfeasance for neglecting to take any action up to now to protect our gold. Under the circumstances, Proxmire may well look upon a public investigation of our missing gold as a can of worms for him. But, my friends, we do not want Proxmire's hide. We want his help. He is in the best possible position to do it, if he will. And there is an inkling that perhaps he can be persuaded to take action. On September 5, my friend Mr. Edward Durrell wrote to Senator Proxmire, urging him to take up the investigation of our nation's gold supplies. Mr. Durrell has done this many times before and has been met with a stone wall. But this time, Mr. Durrell wrote in the wake of your barrage of letters. And on September 11, Proxmire sent this reply, and I now quote, "Dear Mr. Durrell, I have your letter regarding an unreported shipment of gold which occurred at Fort Knox in 1965 and the possibility that there may have been similar unreported incidents. While, as you know, the United States is no longer on the gold standard, I can appreciate your concern in this issue. I have already asked the Treasury Department's Inspector General to look into the matter and give me a complete report. In view of your correspondence, however, I am also asking the Justice Department and the General Accounting Office to also investigate the situation you outline. The General Accounting Office is an investigative arm of the United States Congress. Once I have this information, I will be in a better position to determine whether any future action is warranted. Sincerely, William Proxmire, Chairman." Unquote. My friends, this is still a long way short of agreeing to what we have requested. That is a public investigation by Proxmire's committee. But it is a step in the right direction. So it's up to us to redouble our efforts. We have to make it clear that there are many of us, that we are not going to go away, that we will not be satisfied with anything less than a public investigation by his committee, and that he will have our complete support. To do that, I urge that you again contact Senator Proxmire and get everyone else to do so that you possibly can. And if you are willing to spend a few dollars, I urge you to use a mailgram this time for a greater impact. All you have to do is to call Western Union and they will charge it to your telephone bill. A long message is not necessary. But I suggest that you tell Senator Proxmire you want action, not just comforting form letters. Tell him that you want a public, congressional investigation of our gold supplies by his committee, which has jurisdiction, not more cover-ups by the executive branch. And repeat your pledge of firm support if he will open the investigation which you request. I also have a second suggestion this month, which I think will mean more to you after I tell you the following. The secret gold shipment from Fort Knox on January 20, 1965, took place the very day Lyndon Johnson was inaugurated President, as I reported last month. And I can now reveal, my friends, that this shipment did not end up at the New York Assay Office. It wound up instead in a ranch in Mexico owned jointly by President and Mrs. Johnson. And President Johnson arranged for the Treasury Department to give Mrs. Johnson a special license to deal in gold bullion as a private citizen. Yet at that time, you and I could not even own gold except in jewelry. The Fort Knox gold scandal of today was predictable long ago for those with eyes to see. The famous prophet of the 1929 stock market crash, Roger Ward Babson, gave a clear warning of things to come while the Fort Knox bullion depository was still being built. There was an article about his warnings in the Literary Digest for August 29, 1936. The article described Babson's objections in the words, quote, "By dumping most of America's gold hoard into a steel and concrete strongbox in the mountain fortress at Fort Knox, Kentucky, Uncle Sam is putting too many of his eggs in one basket," unquote. Two very relevant questions posed by Babson were also mentioned. One, is not the United States as liable to have internal revolution as to be attacked by foreign nations? And two, are not gold and commodities much safer distributed among millions of people than stored in Russian fashion under the control of politicians? The article quoted Babson as he thundered, quote, "To secure control of nearly one-half the world's total gold supply requires only securing control of the White House. The key to these great vaults is hanging on the wall of the President's private office," unquote. With those prophetic words of 44 years ago in mind, I now offer you my second suggestion for this month. We need to use every avenue available to begin to make others aware that there is a question about our gold reserves. And so I suggest that you write a brief letter to the editor to every newspaper, large and small, in your area. Don't try to say a lot. Just open up the thought that we ought to think about our gold reserves as we prepare to elect a president. Here is a sample of what I mean to get you started. Letter to the editor. All the presidential candidates this year are talking about our troubled economy in the old conventional terms. But conventional economic cures don't seem to be working. Could it be that the illness is not conventional? Congressional legislation H.R. 7874 is now pending to look into persistent rumors that our monetary gold to back up the dollar is depleted or gone. If so, no wonder the dollar is shrinking and gold prices mushrooming. When we go to the polls, maybe we ought to keep in mind that whoever we vote for we'll have the keys to all our gold, that is, if there is any left. You may succeed in getting only one letter published, or none at all, but all of us working together have to think of ourselves as scattering seed. A lot of our letters to editors, just like seed, will fall on barren land. But if even one letter does get published, it can begin to alert thousands of newspaper readers. So please do it now, my friends. There is no time to be wasted. Now it's time to give you my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've tried to show you a little more clearly the connection between gold and war. Our own gold, which has been stolen from us, is being used to drag you and me into war. So we must seize the gold weapon ourselves and turn it around. By breaking open the gold scandal, we must wage preventive war, a war of truth, in order to prevent a war of missiles, bombs, particle beam weapons, and clashing armies. What happened to the Titan II missile which exploded in its silo earlier this month serves to illustrate the stakes in our preventive war. The secret Bolshevik government of the United States has transformed the Titan II into a first-strike doomsday weapon against Russia. But the Titan II at Damascus, Arkansas, was itself the victim of a Russian first strike. For the first time, the Russians have now demonstrated the ability of their cosmospheres to destroy our ICBMs in their silos. Day by day we come closer and closer to the outbreak of all-out thermonuclear war. The secret rulers of the United States and the rulers of Russia are both embarked on their own separate and very different first-strike strategies. The Bolsheviks here want to achieve a first strike against Russia that will set off all-out war. The Russians, on the other hand, want to achieve the opposite. They want to make all-out war impossible by destroying America's ability to fight. And so, my friends, the Bolsheviks here keep struggling to prepare for a single massive blow at Russia, even though America will be destroyed. And to prevent the massive American first strike, the Russians are conducting a campaign of localized first strikes. One day a Mount St. Helens explodes. Another day a Titan missile explodes. And on another day soon, a major city may seem to explode in a seemingly impossible earthquake. No matter who wins the first strike tug of war, the Russians or the Bolsheviks here, America loses. And my friends, you and I are America. So it is up to you and me to defend our great land and ourselves. No one else is going to do it for us. But our forefathers left us a constitution which grants us the freedom, the power, and the responsibility to do the job. And if our Lord Jesus Christ wills it, we will succeed. 2 months ago, I began giving you my answers to the question many of you had started asking me, what can I do? Many of the things we need to do require little money, but time, dedication, and perseverance. Even so, we must not deceive ourselves. Freedom does not always come for free. The challenge we face today is no less than what our forefathers faced 200 years ago. So if we want to prevail in this struggle, we can do no less than they did. As they expressed it in concluding the Declaration of Independence, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.